Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, December the 18th. We will talk with the author of the new book, Utter Incompetence, this hour, and we will welcome your questions for Thomas Oliphant, correspondent for the Boston Globe and Washington columnist for the Boston Globe since 1989. 1-800-642-1234 is our toll-free number to join in throughout the hour. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. The book chronicles all of the big mistakes of the Bush administration. And it's not just the war in Iraq. It's not just the handling of Hurricane Katrina. Our guest says it's just about everything. Every single issue touched by the Bush administration has flopped. We will try to figure out why and what lessons can be learned. And welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest, whether you agree or disagree with him. Thomas Oliphant is author of Utter Incompetence, Ego and Ideology in the Age of Bush. Good morning.
Good morning and season's greetings.
Yes, season's greetings to you too. You know, I just got done with a conversation with one of our U.S. representatives from Wisconsin, Tammy Baldwin, and somebody who disagreed with her. Because she is joining an effort to start impeachment hearings against Vice President Dick Cheney. And I'm just wondering if what you have chronicled in this book, anything rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors, or is this just bungling?
Not a thing that rises to that level. I mean, I don't oppose investigations or oversight or looking to see behind the headlines on a number of things that are still pending, by the way. But my chronicle is about bungling.
Yeah.
Good old-fashioned bungling, by the way. It's not that there aren't conservative answers to a lot of the issues facing America today. There are, and they're very respectable. What I found over a year of poring over the record of this administration was that there was a consistent pattern of what I call screwing up, missing on the basics. I was trying to account for the fact that politically, I think Americans are as critical of the administration, say, on energy or health care, as they are on, say, the war in Iraq and things like the loss of habeas corpus rights in Guantanamo Bay, that it is across the board. The political sentiment is across the board. And what I wanted to try to see is if there was a substantive basis for that feeling. And I found it in virtually everything Bush has touched.
Yeah, and we've certainly heard a lot about the bungling in the war in Iraq and Hurricane Katrina. But I hadn't heard a lot about all these other things. What was the early flop on energy policy?
Well, you know, it seems like 8 million light years ago, but you'll recall that after all, the administration came to office with two people at the top of it, Bush and Cheney, who had spent years in the energy business. Bush took office at a time, you know, when electricity prices were soaring. There were supply problems, severe supply problems in California, even some brownouts at the time. And Bush had argued during the campaign that, you know, the country hadn't had a comprehensive energy policy in more than a decade, and by golly, he was determined to have one. And so Cheney went off at the head of a task force and spent 5 months looking at it. A lot of the controversy had to do with the secrecy inside the task force, which secrecy being a hallmark of the administration. But what I focused on was the work product. And after 5 months, the high points that Cheney came up with, he described a production problem instead of a demand problem, a supply problem instead of a problem in the world where the growth in places like China and India was producing long-term problems in terms of supply and price. When Bush took office, I think the price of oil was around $20. The price you could get a gallon of gasoline for a dollar. And 7 years later, the price has more than tripled. You know, hundreds of billions of dollars have been transferred from consumers to the industry. The supply situation hasn't gotten materially better. It can't. And yet demand in the world is soaring. In other words, something as basic as energy policy was handled by the administration or not handled by the administration in a way that made the problem vastly more severe than it was.
And say what you might about Dick Cheney, he's not a stupid man. And,
well, this a bullseye. It's a very important point. You know, I struggled with the word incompetence for a long time because to a certain extent, it does sort of imply not qualified. I was finally persuaded that that's not the case, and that incompetence is a behavior problem, not a qualification problem. But certainly, there's no question. After all, Bush himself is the first president in American history with a master's degree in business administration. Right. When the administration was organized, it prided itself on some very orderly, almost business-like procedures that were instituted. And what I kept discovering was that these procedures tended to exacerbate the problems that the president created every time he touched an issue. It was as if you were trying to imagine a particularly noxious brew of bad habits, which in combination could work to screw up, you name the issue, whether it's secrecy, too much reliance on ideology, far more cronyism than you normally see in a presidency, an inability to see things coming, and above all, an inability to do the kinds of mid-course corrections that all successful presidents and administrations do.
And is that because of stubbornness or what?
Well, you know, there's a word that the ancient Greeks bequeathed to us that is so marvelous a description for, it's not entirely stubbornness, but the word I'm thinking of is hubris. To the ancient Greeks, it was an important element in tragedy. And hubris is hard to define, but my definition is the notion that a person is sufficient unto himself, that that you yourself and the little group of people you have around you is entirely sufficient for handling whatever it is that's in your inbox. When in fact, I think the needs of the modern presidency are such that to be successful, a president needs a lot of help outside of his circle. And again, one of the features of the Bush administration, I think people will be studying it for decades to come, is that it was uniquely incapable of the kinds of mid-course corrections that you see in all successful administrations, whether you're talking about Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. When we're talking about the incompetence, are we just talking about President Bush and Vice President Cheney or the entire cabinet? Or
who's... Right. There's another old Greek saying that I love. And that is that the fish rots from the head. And I don't think there's any question that if you're looking at a unique situation in modern politics, and I think you are with Bush, and that is a sustained political collapse of support, it's the public behavior of the president and vice president that matters above all else. As it turned out, they were enabled by a crew of people in both foreign and domestic policy, by the way, who worked with them to effect these astonishing goofs. But the problem began with Bush, and it remains with Bush to this day.
Our guest is Thomas Oliphant, who is the author of Utter Incompetence, Ego and Ideology in the Age of Bush, in which he says it wasn't just the war in Iraq or the handling or mishandling of Hurricane Katrina, that every issue or policy touched by the Bush administration, by President Bush, has been a disaster, has flopped. We will talk more about why this is and what lessons can be learned, and we will welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, At Issue with Ben Marins, and after 4, Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich will join Ben and answer your questions about his candidacy and his positions on issues. So your chance to talk with Dennis Kucinich, congressman from Ohio and candidate for president, after 4 o'clock this afternoon. We are talking about why President Bush and his team, his administration, actually very smart people, keep making the same mistakes over and over and over again. Why every single issue, domestic or foreign or international, has been a real flop, according to our guest, who is the author of the book Utter Incompetence. Thomas Oliphant is a correspondent for the Boston Globe, has been the paper's Washington columnist since 1989. He also was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 1975 for coverage of the city of Boston's traumatic school desegregation issue. We are talking about the mistakes made by the Bush administration and what lessons can be learned from them. And our first caller is Bob in Minong. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Good morning. First of all, you have a guest whose views are certainly worth listening to, regardless of your political stripe. A couple of years ago, I was on an airplane seated next to a medical student from a young gal from Brazil. She asked me about my politics. I said, I'm a Republican. She said, well, did you vote for George Bush? I said, yes, I did. What do you think of him? I said, well, I think he's kind of stupid. And she said, well, why in the world did you vote for him? And I said, because I thought the other fellow was even more stupid. Which leads me to the point I want to make, Tom. We could end up with a couple of bad candidates in 2008. Is there something wrong with the way we pick our presidential candidates and presidents that keeps our best people from being in the arena?
Yeah.
What is wrong?
Well, you know, that question gets right to the heart of the matter. It involves, if we want to think about it carefully, it involves qualifications. And the comment that I'm tempted to make is that American history tells us something a little counterintuitive about our presidents. It is not true, for example, that the greatest presidents have necessarily been the best prepared. I don't know how you could have looked at Abraham Lincoln in 1959 and considered him a genius, even smart. He certainly didn't have a track record. And yet, there have been other presidents whose records have been mediocre at best, who seemed magnificently qualified for the office. One of the things I've learned in my 40 years in this racket is that if you see the presidential politics as something akin to, say, a job interview, The normal ingredients, whether it's resume or how you respond when you're asked questions, don't seem to provide a particularly good roadmap to the right selection, or shall I say the best selections. I don't know that I'd agree with you that Bush or Al Gore are or were stupid. My experience with the two of them is that rather the reverse is true. I think the criterion that makes more sense to me is successful or unsuccessful. And I think it has more to do with how inclusive you are, and how flexible you are. This is an incredibly complicated job in modern America. And my experience has been that presidents who know how to reach beyond their own inner circle, who know that the shortest distance between two points is not always a straight line in government, are the ones that have the best chance of being successful. And the ones who are inflexible, whether it's because of ideology or hubris or both, are the ones that get into trouble.
Yeah. An email from Phil. I'm not sure where Phil is from. I don't think this is incompetence. Maybe this was the game plan all along. Wars abroad and almost dictatorial powers at home.
Well, that's a very strong statement, more of an ideological one, I think, than a descriptive one. You know, there are one argument that I've run into a great deal, both while I was doing my research and since the book came out, is whether having very very conservative leaders at the helm means that you've got people who don't really believe in government charged with the responsibility of overseeing it. And in modern times, I just don't think that analytical point holds much water. Conservatives, most of them anyway, have long ago made their peace with most elements of the modern state. There are revolutionary aspects of conservative doctrine, just as there are revolutionary aspects of liberal doctrine. But by and large, I think most people accept the essential outlines of the government as they see it. And so the least satisfactory explanation for what's happened in the last 7 years, for me anyway, is conspiracy.
I'm sorry, why is
conspiracy?
That?
I don't think anybody set out to fail. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody set out to ruin the standing of the administration politically. Rather, I think that the worst habits you can have in modern government just happen to be the basic habits of this particular administration. And most of it, I don't think, had all that much to do with ideology.
Yeah. Well, you might have answered David's point, but David in South Milwaukee, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, but, you know, this is the Ideas Network, and it's good to kick this one around a little bit. I'd like to take that same point and focus just on the Iraq War.
Uh-huh.
And recently, Afghanistan kind of falls into the same sorry bucket. In criminal law, there are degrees of culpability. First and foremost, the worst level is premeditated intent. Then next, and this is getting to your book, there's conduct that's so extremely reckless as to constitute, in a reasonable person's mind, premeditation. If I drive 75 miles an hour through a school zone and kill a child, I don't get charged with manslaughter or negligent homicide. I get charged with reckless homicide, which is the same as premeditation. If you look what went on in the Iraq War alone, and for the, you know, my Republican friends, I'll never convince them, but for the rest of us, we understand the level of incompetencies. But you stack them up. It's so egregious. The idiots are not stupid people. They did this on purpose.
Well, I was with you right up until that last sentence, they did this on purpose. Using the public record as our shared factual background here, because I don't think the secret record is much different, what I think the record shows is shall I say, a reckless certainty that all of this could be done easily, in and out, in about 90 to 120 days. That's the core. In other words, a lot of Americans had widely varying opinions about whether the United States should invade Iraq, whether there were other ways of undermining Saddam Hussein's regime, what should we do. Opinion was all over the place. What I think distinguishes President Bush's and Dick Cheney's behavior is this. Now, here, you're the lawyer, so you're going to have to help me on your definitions of culpability. There was an absolute certainty that at very minimal cost, the United States could get in and within 6 months or less get out. It was a certainty that was not tested by the normal kinds of outside consultations that normally precede a big step. So reckless, I certainly agree. I don't know how able I am to keep going with the analogy of the person recklessly speeding through a school zone. But I do know from the record that it was the administration's belief from President Bush right on down that this would be easy. There was plenty of opinion, plenty of informed and expert opinion that it would not be that easy. And the key error, as far as I'm concerned, is not paying attention to the viewpoint that this was not the cakewalk that it seemed at the time, and that we could get in and get out that quickly at such little cost. I mean, it seems like it happened a million years ago. Actually, it was just 5 years ago that the mistake was in the process of being made. And I just, to repeat myself, don't think there's any question but that the key mental problem here was the certainty that it could be done easily and quickly.
Yeah. And your book came out, I think, was published certainly before the latest news on Iran, but
right.
the same thing was happening there, wasn't
it? Here we go again. You know, when I was, one of the great dilemmas you always face, I guess, when you're doing current history in book form is when to cut off the research. And on the one hand, it's a problem for an author. On the other hand, I couldn't help but keep referring to President Bush as the gift that keeps on giving. And you're almost faced with an embarrassment of riches in terms of material, and organizing it was a real challenge. But yes, you're absolutely right. Just in the last few weeks, there have been two events, actually, that reminded me of what I went through in my research. One was the complete flip-flop on what our intelligence community's conclusion is to what it is that's going on in Iran with regard to the nuclear fuel cycle. The other one, interestingly, was the discovery that videotapes had been made of some of the interrogations of detainees beginning in 2002, and that in secret a little bit more than 2 years ago, they were destroyed. A classic goof, really, because again, forgetting whether you're a lefty or a righty, when a government does that, destroys material evidence, there's not only a legal problem called obstruction of justice, there's also a political problem, because most people in politics will tell you that you can never keep secrets like that, and that if you indulge in behavior like that, it's going to come back and bite you for sure. And lo and behold, it did.
An email from Fred and Baraboo asking the question, why is the Bush administration so adamant about keeping nearly everything secret? Is it because they know what is being done is illegal, or is that Bush and Cheney realize what is being done is inept?
Well, what a good question, because again, this gets to the heart of the larger question. How could this happen virtually across the board over a 7-year period? And in describing the process, and believe me, you can do this if the subject is taxes or if the subject is the war in Iraq. But one of the themes that existed at the moment President Bush took office was a generalized belief that the power of the presidency had been allowed to slip in recent years, and that the office needed to be strengthened. Now, that's a point of view that reasonable people can disagree about in an agreeable way. It's possible to understand that President Bush's basic notion was a sensible one. But how does a sensible notion become an almost irrational preoccupation? And that's where you get back to this notion of an especially noxious brew of bad traits. It's one thing to vigorously defend the office. It's something else to find yourself in a situation where virtually everything you do, you're trying to shield yourself from either scrutiny or, much more importantly, accountability. I think the roots of it were with this energy task force. Every White House, at least in modern times, has had this problem of what we in the writing trade call the bubble. The creation of this hermetically sealed environment within which a president and his top assistants work. There's always a temptation to try to make that bubble as hermetically sealed as possible. I think the record shows that successful administrations let a little air into that bubble. But early on, President Bush got in the habit of trying to dodge both oversight and accountability, whether it's not doing anything about soaring energy prices or not doing anything about soaring health insurance premiums or handling terrorism and the war in Iraq. And before you know it, you're stuck in a mode. As near as I can tell, this preoccupation with secrecy has done nothing except exacerbate the president's political problems. I cannot, viewed over time, I can't think of one of these bad habits that has helped him.
Let's go to John in Milwaukee now. Hi, John.
Hi. I had 2 points I wanted to make. One was hubris that your guest was talking about started right from the very beginning, and we didn't hold him accountable for it. And that was when he nominated Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney was a resident of Houston, Texas, working for Halliburton. The U.S. Constitution has a requirement that the president and the vice president cannot be from the same state, and they were at that time from the same state. So the night before, Dick Cheney changed his voting registration to Wyoming, and we allowed him to get away with that. That's an example of hubris where they violated the Constitution. There's a constitutional requirement that the president and vice president. My second point is we have, nobody's talking about it, but we've added 65% to the national debt. The national debt is the sum total of every deficit of every president in the history of the United States. So George W. Bush is responsible for 65%. It's gone. When Bill Clinton left office, the national debt was around $5.6 trillion. He took the largest deficit from Bush's father, and he turned it into the largest surplus in U.S. history.
Right, and you do talk about that issue in your book.
There's a whole chapter, Joy. Help me out for a second, Joy, and don't let me forget about the national debt. But let me start with Cheney for a second. There are ironies here. I remember vividly working to figure out who Bush was going to pick in the summer of 2000. And what I remember distinctly is that the choice of Cheney, and by the way, the business about his residency, the question of whether it is or isn't a technical violation of the law to fix it the way they did is still being debated, and I don't want to pretend expertise on that. But I want to recall the political atmosphere when Cheney was selected, and that was that Bush had done something to reassure the country, believe it or not. That despite the fact that his own resume was a bit thin when it came to governance, He had chosen one of the Republican Party's most experienced and, we always thought, most competent figures.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked to reassure the public during the latter stages of the 2000 campaign, and it actually worked to reassure the public in the early weeks of the administration. In terms of what made this turn out to be a horrible choice, I think the answer can be found in something that was said to me by one of the first of these partner vice presidencies in modern time, a neighbor of yours, Fritz Mondale of mm-hmm. Minnesota. Mondale has always believed that full partnership can only work when there's no question that the vice president is there to help carry out a president's agenda, and that any time this relationship gets polluted by what is seen to be a separate agenda on the vice president's part, you're headed toward ruin. And that is the essence of what turned out to be wrong with Cheney. Now, I know we get all excited when we talk about, oh, everything from secrecy to cronyism to the war in Iraq, but what I think the core of the problem has been from the beginning is that Cheney came into office with his own agenda, and that nothing in American governance is more dangerous than that. And Bush never really did anything about it. I think even to this day, you can see evidence of Cheney pursuing an agenda that is not quite the same as Bush's. And so that's it. Now, as to the national debt,
let me have you wait on the answer or the reaction to our caller's complaints about the way Bush has handled the national debt until after this short pause. And this reminder that we are talking with Thomas Oliphant, who is a correspondent for the Boston Globe and the author of Utter Incompetence: Ego and Ideology in the Age of Bush. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn will host her December Open Line. That's coming up in our next hour. We are talking with Thomas Oliphant, who is the author of Utter Incompetence, Ego and Ideology in the Age of Bush, which chronicles all of the mistakes of the Bush administration, and there are a lot of them, and a book that wonders why seemingly intelligent people running the Bush administration could make so many mistakes time after time after time, virtually every issue touched. And one of those issues, the national debt, Tom?
Yes. Mm. You know, again, one could hardly argue that Bush came into office with the goal of tripling the size of the national debt. The really challenging question is, how did it end up soaring on his watch? And here I think you can see what ideology can do to distort a president's agenda.
Yeah. So how did it triple under his watch?
Well, you know, obviously there's a part of this that any president would have had to face, and that is some of the increase in military expenditures mm-hmm. made necessary after 9/11. It's also true that that there was an economic slowdown in the year 2001 that made the budget situation worse than it otherwise would have been. Though you can argue that one of the problems with the economy is that the president has left it alone to create even more problems. But the tax cuts. Mm-hmm. Again, it's a perfectly respectable opinion that the surplus that was looming in the year 2000 should have been returned to the people in the form of tax cuts. Reasonable people can agree or disagree on that. The problem is when you let tax cutting go from being an ideological preference to being an obsession. And And I think here is a case where an administration let itself become obsessed with taxes instead of managing the situation, recognizing that sometimes you have to tack a little bit along the way. And to have these enormous tax cuts, first in 2001 and then in 2003, without any regard to the impact they were having on the budget, because you elevate tax cuts to an almost theological position of prominence, is virtually begging for the problem you end up with, namely the tripling of the national debt on your watch.
Yeah, didn't the Bush administration, though, weren't they crowing that these tax cuts actually reduced at least the deficit by increasing tax collections because
well,
these rich people...
The extreme version of that point of view is not true, namely that they pay for themselves. We, after 25 years of experience, we know that they do not pay for themselves. It's certainly true that to an extent, as long as it's moderate and reasonable, tax cuts can stimulate economic activity, which in turn stimulates revenue. That's almost a truism. But again, if you take it to an ideological extreme, let it become an obsession, and then are unable to adjust your policies, make mid-course corrections, that is how you can lose control of the fiscal resources of the government, along with another wrinkle that is unique to Bush, and that is he is a conservative president. Who has had great difficulty restraining his spending impulses in the last 7 years. That makes him an unusual conservative, not a typical one. And in my research, I found it helpful to offer the contrast with Ronald Reagan. No one, all these years later, no one doubts Reagan's belief in the efficacy of lower marginal income tax rates. That was a very firm, fervent belief on his part. However, in the 1980s, Reagan regularly compromised with Congress, either to deal with problems that came up because of his policies, or because he changed his mind, or because he was trying to get the broadest possible consensus politically. It's true there were enormous tax cuts, at least for that time, in the first year of Reagan's presidency, but it is also true that taxes were increased in every subsequent year of the Reagan presidency. I use Reagan as a classic illustration of my contention that in government, the shortest distance between two points is not necessarily a straight line at all, and Reagan knew how to tack. I think Bush has gotten into trouble on domestic policies repeatedly because he has been unable and unwilling to do the kind of tacking and compromising and adjusting that is always the hallmark of successful presidents. It has nothing to do with compromising basic beliefs, as Reagan illustrates.
Yeah. Let me get some more callers in.
Sure.
Boyd in Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Joy, and hello to your guest. Very, very good show. To get to the point, you know, you talked about incompetence and stuff like that, and still a lot of people have said that when it came to the war in Iraq, that I really believe that the president and the administration was not going to settle for anything yet less than a war. And people who defend his decision of going to Iraq said he was going with the intelligence from foreign countries such as France and Russia, who really believed Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. My response to those has been this. If, let's say, that was the case, they should have taken that evidence, provided it to the UN, and had the weapons inspectors do their job and use also that evidence to increase their, you know, to help them with their job. I remember seeing ads that basically said, let the inspectors do their job. Do you think really that the administration was not going to settle for anything less but a war?
I think the record is clear that by the fall of 2002, at least, if not a few months before, once President Bush started quietly authorizing the movement of combat troops to the Gulf, that he was determined to go. You know, you raise the weapons of mass destruction, the widespread belief, I think, as you put it. It's important to be precise about this. There was a very broad suspicion in the world that Saddam Hussein had retained quantities of chemical weapons. You know, there was an argument about whether research and development was going on in the nuclear area or not. But the widespread belief was that he had retained some chemical, possibly even a biological weapon or two, which turned out not to be the case. But it reminds me of one road not taken as the date for the invasion got closer and closer and closer, and it was a suggestion made by those people we loved to hate for a while, the French. And one suggestion that was made in the United Nations Security Council is that the real way to test this was to double, triple, even quadruple the size of the UN inspection force, almost to the point where you were invading Iraq with an unarmed army of inspectors. The thinking behind it, which turned out to be actually accurate, was that the reason for Saddam Hussein's secrecy, what caused him to disobey all these UN resolutions down through the years, was that he was trying to keep secret from his own people the fact that he didn't have anything. Right. In other words, that this was a paper tiger that very much needed the aura of dangerous weapons in order to maintain power. And the idea of the French, which, as I say, it actually turned out to be pretty shrewd, was that we could have unmasked him as the poseur he was, possibly led to his overthrow without any need for an invasion. That's one example of a road not taken. I think as time has passed and President Bush has suffered this irreversible political damage because of what he did and didn't do, you begin to see these roads not taken. And again, there's nothing liberal or conservative about the French idea with UN inspectors. It's just a different policy choice. And it is this unwillingness to consider alternative points of view, alternative courses of action, much less to adjust in the middle, that is such a hallmark of President Bush's governance, no matter what the topic is.
Paul in Glendale, in an email, wonders, what do you think is the best example of Bush-Cheney incompetence, or something other than what we've already talked about?
Well, what I tried to do in structuring this work was to focus on domestic issues first and issues that came up even before 9/11. Forget about Iraq and Katrina, in order to get the pattern established so that Bush didn't seem all that out of character when he starts mishandling Iraq. And one of my favorite has been this question of tax cuts. What a tremendous opportunity the conservative movement had when he took office in 2001. It was the first time since the 1920s that the Republicans had controlled the White House and Congress. And in pushing ahead with a very, very radical tax cut proposal, Bush was trying to take advantage of this unique political situation. But there was a problem within a couple of months of his inauguration, namely that Congress had chipped away a little bit at the size it wanted to allow for these tax cuts. About a fifth of the size had been pared down. And so the issue before the president in 2001 was, how do you adjust your proposal so that it fits within the broad parameters Congress is in the process of establishing? Well, Bush decided he didn't want to do that. He wanted everything. And in order to get everything, he made a couple of basic mistakes that have come back to haunt him in his second term and will probably ruin this conservative dream of a permanent reduction in tax rates. Number one, he assumed revenue that the government was never going to collect, namely from this ridiculous alternative minimum tax, as if it would continue on into the future. And, of course, every year Congress keeps it from spreading its impact. But much more importantly, he came up with this gimmick, along with Cheney, by the way, and that was to magically have all the tax cuts expire after 2010 so that he could fit it all within a budget by assuming there were no tax cuts at all in the 10th year. Well, you never should make assumptions about what the political or legislative climate is going to be in the future. If you have a chance to take something, you should take it. And the result of that mistake, if you're a conservative, is that Bush is probably going to lose at least half of these tax cuts when they simply expire in 2 years.
Yeah.
And that is not some accident of the calendar. This is going to happen because Bush and Cheney screwed up this program at the beginning.
I don't want to ruin your ending, but what is the lesson for the next administration?
Well, you know, this has become a little, it's a point of argument in the presidential campaign right now. In other words, I'm making the point that it is not all that hard, despite the complexities of modern life, to be a successful president. If you're adaptable, open, if you know how to change in the middle, if you can wheel and deal a little bit, the system is going to be very friendly to you. You really have to work hard to screw up in a major way in this office. But the question for one of the questions for the future is, does that mean the most important quality you should be looking for in the next president should it involve competence and experience and judgment? And obviously, to a certain extent, it should, because while vision is very important, I think the most important lesson of George W. Bush is that it really matters how you conduct yourself in the office, because it is so easy on paper for a president to ruin his administration through maladministration. And so I'm afraid one of the morals of this story is that while grand visions are inspiring, even important, a judgment about whether somebody has the flexibility, the openness, the inclusiveness to govern is probably the most important choice we make, even if we don't realize it.
We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
And it was a pleasure.
Yeah. Thomas Oliphant is a correspondent for the Boston Globe, has been a Washington columnist since 1989. His new book, Utter Incompetence. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.